Probably one of the worst characteristics of the thoughtless speaker is his inability to read the reaction of his audience. As with the man I mentioned who was standing too far back from the microphone, no one could hear what he was saying, but he remained oblivious to the many signals the audience was giving him. True, they weren't standing up and yelling at him or cupping their ears with their hands, but he should have been able to read their restlessness, their looking at each other, the occasional shaking of heads. They weren't getting it, and he was totally oblivious to the fact. By looking at the faces of your audience, you can usually tell whether or not you're doing a good job. Not every time, by any means. I've seen people in my audiences many times who appeared to be outright hostile to what I was saying, who seemed to be trying to tell me by their expressions that I was a blithering idiot. Yet I've learned over the years that it's often these same people who come up to the head table afterwards with the most profusive compliments and expressions of gratitude. They just happen to look like that. They wear customary frowns and their mouths turned down at the corners as though they had just bitten into a dill pickle. That's the way they look. The best indicator by far in my book is the silence, or lack of it. People in groups are normally noisy. Even when they're not talking, if you shut your eyes and listen, you can imagine that you're deep in a jungle filled with strange creatures. The snorting, coughing, blowing of noses, clearing of throats, scraping of chairs, sliding of feet, we're noisy creatures, we humans. And our noise diminishes and stops completely only when we're very much interested in something. Only when we're trying to hear something very clearly. Then, we're totally silent. And that's the feedback you're mainly looking for. Silent attention. It's the best indicator in the world that you're succeeding as a speaker. We've all heard the expression, he held the audience in the palm of his hand. I don't go along with that. It's his subject and the way in which it's delivered that does the job. Nor are we, nor will anyone get absolute silence during an entire speech. People are going to make a certain amount of noise as someone suddenly has to cough or blow his nose or knocks over something. I've had sounds come from audiences you wouldn't believe. And no speaker, no matter how accomplished, is going to do a perfect or even near-perfect job every time. Even Jack Nicklaus loses tournaments. I saw him shoot in the 80s one time at Pebble Beach, and no matter how good you become at judging what the so-called silent audience is trying to say to you, how they're reacting to your speech, you're going to be better on some days, worse on some days, bad on some days, and absolutely magnificent on some days. If you can hit a high good average, you're doing a good job. But sometimes you don't feel well yourself. You're just down. And even when you give it all you've got, it's not going to be as good as it will be on days when you're up, when everything's right. Keep in mind, too, that there may be one or more people in the audience who do not react well to you and what you're saying. Don't keep looking at them. Look at the people who agree with you. It's better for your morale. But it's good to be aware that you have people in your audience who are unimpressed. It makes you try to do better. If someone falls asleep while you're talking, don't take all the blame. He probably needs his sleep. I've been asked many times what I think about the learning while you sleep techniques we've heard of from time to time. You're supposed to put a speaker under your pillow and listen to tape recordings while you're asleep. The theory is that you'll actually learn the material being listened to. My response is that I used to fall asleep occasionally in school, but I don't remember learning anything. If you've been doing much public speaking, you remember how you felt the first time someone in your audience stood up and walked out of the room. Your stomach dropped out. A dry constriction grabs the back of your throat. Often the new speaker will be so flabbergasted and surprised you'll stop talking, stunned. It hadn't occurred to him that someone might just get up and walk out of the room for any one of 10,000 excellent reasons. He may have to keep an important engagement. In fact, I've had thoughtful people come up to me before a speech to tell me that they would have to leave before I finished. The hardest thing for a beginning speaker to get used to is that people have lives to live, which they consider more important than listening to a speech, no matter how interesting. And when they have to do whatever it is, they must rise and quietly walk out of the room. It does not mean that they're walking out because they don't like your speech or because they're in angry disagreement with you. Haven't you ever had to leave a speech before it ended? I have. Yes, but it's always disconcerting. And those of us who are extremely sensitive to criticism we'll always feel a stab of self-doubt when we see a deserter get up and leave. It is not feedback, however, necessarily. It can be, but if you're not on an extremely controversial subject involving politics or religion or a sensitive local issue, chances are the deserter simply has to leave for personal reasons, and is no reflection whatever upon your ululations. In fact, he's usually embarrassed to have to make such a stir. Well, the whole idea of this message is to help us be aware of and sensitive to, but not too sensitive, to audience feedback. An audience is responding to the speaker at all times. They respond with their attention or the lack of it, with their body movements, with sounds like a zoo at midnight. They're human beings with all kinds of problems you and I don't know about. But they're capable of being completely interested and entertained, and when that happens, they will respond as human beings have responded since the dawn of human history. They'll laugh in all the right places. They'll be moved by sadness and poignancy and will cry at the right places. And they'll be absolutely silent when you have their complete interest. Don't concern yourself with trying to win every member of the audience, especially if your subject is one of social criticism. If you're indicting modern education, you're not going to throw the teachers in your audience into paroxysms of helpless laughter. No matter what your subject may be, you're bound to have listeners who are not in agreement with you, unless you're giving them pure, unadulterated pap. Trying to win over every member of your audience is an impossible and thankless task. The important thing is your subject and what you're trying to say. You're not there to please your audience, necessarily. You're there to inform them. And if somebody jumps up in a huff and storms out of the room in very obvious objection to what you're saying, don't worry about it. Remember, there were those who disagreed with wise, kind Socrates. Don't attempt to manipulate your audience. Don't play God. Say what you have to say in the very best way that you can say it. Close, thank the nice people, and sit down. You'll instantly know how good you were by the response. If they leap to their feet as one person, clapping and shouting approval, try to get a quick picture of it, because the chances of it ever happening again are very slim. It does happen, but don't ever try for it. Remember what you're trying to do, and do it the best you can. Learning to watch for audience reaction and feedback is the mark of a sensitive, conscientious speaker. I think they're the best kind, and I'm sure you'll be one. Thank you. The title of this message is, Who Do You Think You're Talking To? It's bad grammar. It should be, Whom Do You Think You're Talking To? But it's an old American pre-combat question. I remember being a new kid in school when I was in high school on the football and basketball teams and thought I was something special. I became uncomfortably aware that I was under the searching stare of a boy in the next row. I turned and looked at him. He didn't blink an eye. He just went on regarding me as though I were a specimen unearthed on a scientific expedition of some sort. I gave him the famous line, What do you think you're looking at? Whereupon, without a bit of hesitation and in a maddeningly calm voice, he replied, Not very much. I've saved that line, and if I'm ever asked that question by some churl or boor, I'll let him have it. The question, Who do you think you're talking to, is often asked in the same spirit of burgeoning belligerence. It's an indication that we've overstepped that person's threshold of tolerance. We've offended him in some way. Now, I mentioned in an earlier message the occasion in which an entire audience stood up and walked out of the room, leaving the speaker a room full of empty chairs. He had offended their intelligence. He had spoken to them as though they were wayward children, without even the beginning rudiments of an education. The speaker was an insensitive bore who had not taken the measure of his audience. Quite often I've been on a program containing more than one speaker and have heard speakers, especially those exceptional salesmen who've been asked to speak to other salesmen, address their audience as though it were comprised of beginning nincompoops. They fail to realize that sitting out there in that audience were some very successful people, men and women who had achieved the very top of the selling profession. What's more, there were dozens, possibly hundreds of other people in the audience who were quite successful in their work. People who were supporting families and sending kids to college who had read most of the books and heard most of the speeches over the years. To speak to such people as though they were beginners is to thoughtlessly insult them. They're deeply offended by such unthinking speakers, and they're saying silently, "Who do you think you're talking to?" Well, the purpose of all of this is to suggest that we never underestimate our audience. People are usually a lot smarter than the casual observer might give them credit for being. And it's a good idea if you're going to pass along some information to precede it with some kind of thoughtful disclaimer. I often use one that goes something like this. We all need reminding. Will Rogers said that none of us is smart enough to remember everything he knows, and so I'm going to remind you of a few basics here today that our busy world sometimes tends to cause us to lose sight of. You know, when you go to your golf pro because your game is beginning to slip a bit, he seldom tells you anything new. He simply reminds you, again, of a few basics which, when remembered, help us play a much better game. Well, that's my job here today, to remind you of a few basics that we tend to lose sight of. Now, the word remind carries with it the connotation that the people in your audience already know what you're going to say. It means you think they're as smart as you are, which in all likelihood is true. It's a simple way of giving your audience credit for having brains and experience. It disarms them. They can relax now and enjoy the speech. No matter what you say, even if it's something completely new to them, they can comfortably act as if they already knew it. You're not putting them down. You're not preaching to them. You're on their own level. You're one of them. You're on their side of the desk or podium. You're learning or being reminded with them instead of pontificating at them. And there's an important difference. Nor should we harangue our audience to do as we have done. There are many ways to a given destination. You've taken one way. Others may choose other routes they prefer. I remember how one speaker who was deeply religious offended his audience. Being a very religious man, his program for success involved getting up very early in the morning, and after running a mile and taking care of his office work, which also involved outlining his plan for the day, he would attend church every morning of the week. "And that's the way you do it," he belabored the audience. "That's the only way you're going to succeed in this business," he would yell at the top of his voice. Well, he offended his audience. He might have also caused some young people to doubt that they could succeed in any other way. He confused his way with the only way. I think it's a great idea to rise early and run a mile before breakfast. It's also a good idea to make your plans for the day, make a list of what needs to be done, and get the details out of the way. And certainly, for the deeply religious, going to church every morning could be an inspiring way to begin the day. But none of these things is essential to success as a human being. It all depends on the person. Some very successful people get up quite late, never exercise, never go to church. He should have said, "This is my way," instead of, "This is the only way." To the intelligent people in his audience, he made himself ridiculous. To the beginners, he was confusing and perhaps frightening. He was like the foreman at the plant on the morning that a new employee shows up for work who says, "Now pay careful attention. This is the way it's done around here." It shuts out all creativity. It slams the door on improvement and innovation. He should have said, "This is the way we do this particular job. If you can come up with a better way, we're interested." I remember reading someplace that no matter how certain we are of something, the odds are at the very best about 80% that we're right. It's so much better to say, "Now I've found that this system works wonderfully for me. Perhaps if you're so disposed, you'd care to try it." Never slam the door so that the people in your audience are left with no alternatives. When you've been asked to speak, you are, in effect, the guest of the audience, and the situation calls for good manners. If you're called on to give an invocation, it's important to remember that there are probably people in the room of different faiths, so that it's important not to be too specific. A general, all-faiths kind of invocation is best. The definition of a gentleman is that people are never uncomfortable or embarrassed in his company. Now that's why the knowledgeable speaker never tells off-color jokes. I've heard jokes from people at the microphone that have made me squirm in my seat, and I spent 8 years in the U.S. Marine Corps. I've heard stories like that when women were present. It's unforgivable. It's in execrable taste. It's low class. Even if women aren't present, many men are deeply offended by dirty jokes. And there's a simple way to never offend in such a matter. Never, ever tell an off-color joke. unless it's extremely mild and in good taste and has a definite connection with the proceedings. No one has to take unnecessary chances to be funny. The funniest situations are never embarrassing to tell or to listen to. Well, to sum up, don't make any assumptions about the people in your audience. If you must assume something, assume that they're all different, which they are, and every bit as smart and well-informed in their way as you are in yours. We used to have a saying in Chicago advertising, never underestimate the consumer. She's your wife. Thank you. There's an old story about a farmer working in his fields who was hailed by a passing stranger. After exchanging greetings, the stranger said, "I'm planning to settle up ahead in the next town. What are the people like up there?" And the farmer asked, "What were the people like where you came from?" "They were terrible," answered the stranger. "They complained all the time. They were miserable to talk to and to do business with. Very unfriendly." "You'll find the people in the next town are the same way," the farmer said. And the stranger rode on, shaking his head in his unhappiness. Soon another stranger came by and, by coincidence, asked the farmer the same question. "What were the people like in the town you came from?" the farmer again asked. "They were wonderful people. Warm, genuine, and friendly," the stranger said. "You'll find the people in the next town are exactly like that," replied the farmer. And the same good advice applies to audiences. They will respond to our attitude. It's uncanny the way an audience can sense the true feelings of a speaker. It's as though the speaker and his audience were connected by invisible wires. They cannot know what's bothering him unless there are visible manifestations of nervousness or stage fright, but they sense that all is not right, and they become wary, on edge. Every speaker of quality, I believe, suffers from nervousness before a speech, the degree of it depending upon the makeup of the audience he's to face. But like most, I feel that's a good thing. It puts us on our mettle. We get up for the speech, as they say, and we work hard at doing a good job. I find it helps me a great deal if I can develop a kind of love for the audience before I begin to talk. Now, by love, I mean a feeling of agape, which originally meant a feeling of love between Christians, but which can certainly include all people regardless of their religious leanings. It's a feeling of brotherhood. After all, we all belong to the same club, the same species. Our humanity is our membership card. And we can develop a feeling of liking, of being glad we're there at that moment. And I believe that feeling is transmitted to the audience. Audiences, I think, like most people most of the time, seem to dwell in a kind of neutral. They're not particularly negative, nor are they particularly positive. They're waiting to respond to whatever stimulus we provide. If it's good, if it's warm and positive and contains a feeling of love or liking or brotherhood, they seem to sense it and respond in a positive way. We've all seen cases, hundreds, thousands of times, in which a well-known, very funny comedian comes on stage. The audience knows he's very funny, and they begin to laugh even before he says anything particularly funny. He could say simply, "Hello," and they'd laugh. They are preconditioned to laugh. They're ready to laugh. They can hardly wait to laugh. His act is a big success even before getting started. Well, we don't always have that kind of preconditioned audience when we enter a room or appear at the microphone. We're often an unknown quantity. With time and experience, we can achieve the preconditioning of an audience, and it makes it much easier and better, but in the beginning, we have to create a good mood within ourselves if we want a favorable initial response from the audience. By liking your audience before you begin, you set the stage, which is so important, for what you have to sell. We might call it the package in which you and your words are to appear. It's an important part of marketing, as we all know. Without it, with a cold or negative audience to overcome, it's much tougher. Remember the famous laws of physics that go, a body in motion tends to remain in motion until acted upon by an outside force. Conversely, a motionless body tends to remain motionless. It's harder to get a motionless body started than to keep a moving body moving. There's a book out which has a title that goes, if I remember correctly, The First 4 Minutes. I may be wrong on the actual words, but that's the idea of the book at any rate. The book talks about the importance of that first impression. We can overcome a poor or average first impression with a good speech and wind up a big success, but it's a lot better to begin a winner. So, like your audience, even if it's hard for you at first. Liking your audience will go a long way toward dispelling nervousness and stage fright. We enjoy talking to people we like. It's fun, and we can have a good time doing it. Most people are nice people. They want the same things you and I want. They want to enjoy your speech. They're looking forward to hearing you. Actually, you've got everything going for you, and there's no reason in the world to be fearful or consider the people in your audience hostile toward you. The fact that they're not all wearing big friendly smiles isn't important. They want you to succeed. They want to enjoy your speech. You can enjoy it with them if you begin with the right attitude, as you probably know. That word attitude, you know, has been called the most important word in the language. It's magic. It can work wonders and overcome tremendous odds. And people tend to respond favorably toward a good attitude. It's believed and often said that if you get to know anyone really well, you'll like him. I don't know if I go along with that completely, but I'm sure it's true in the overwhelming majority of cases. Keep in mind that there's a human tendency in all of us, but the occasional 100% 18-carat boor, to underestimate ourselves and to unconsciously give more credit than we give to ourselves to others. We're a lot better than we tend to consider ourselves, and when it comes time to stand up there on your own and make that speech, well, it helps to muster confidence that you're there for a good reason. The people are good people. They want you to succeed, and they'll do all they can to respond favorably to you if you'll have the right attitude toward them. So like your audience. Remember, you've been in a few audiences yourself. You know how you feel. Thank you. Meetings are often preceded by cocktail hours. It is perhaps an unfortunate custom. To have a few drinks before dinner and good fellowship is fine. To have a few drinks before dinner and good fellowship followed by an after-dinner speaker is not necessarily a good idea. But it is a custom, and all speakers are familiar with it. After 3 or 4 drinks and a big meal, few human beings, especially after a day's work, are alert and in happy anticipation of a speech. Most would much rather head for home in a comfortable bed after some bicarbonate of soda and a short lecture from the wife on staying out late and drinking during the week. The cocktail hour puts the speaker in a unique and particularly dangerous situation. If he has a couple of drinks with the boys, then dinner, followed by the official business of the club, he would much rather head for home in a comfortable bed, too. Alcohol is a depressant. It slows us down. It dulls the critical faculties. There is no way to make as good a speech after a couple of drinks as there is without a couple of drinks. For me, drinking before a speech is outright disaster. Standing on your feet and making an interesting and informative talk to a group of tired and slightly smashed human beings calls for every bit of alertness and sharpness you can muster. Drinking before dinner is absolutely out of the question for the speaker. If you want to have a couple of drinks with the boys before dinner, don't accept a speech. If you've accepted a speech, make the sacrifice. Don't have a drink until after the speech. Even one drink will dull the edges of your talk. You'll reach for a special word, and it won't be there. You know it's in the room someplace, and your mind gropes frantically for it, but it must be hiding behind the sofa, and you find yourself covering up for it. The zest, the sparkle, the bright, clean edge of your talk is dulled and sicklied o'er. Right. You shouldn't have had that drink. But you want to be relaxed. You want to be smiling and casual. One of the boys. So you have a drink. After a drink, your confidence increases and you begin to think that you're going to make the best speech of your life. If that much confidence can be mustered with one drink, 2 will surely be even better. And sure enough, you feel even more confident. Until the time comes for you to stand up and make your speech. It's then that you realize you've made a serious mistake. You're not only dull, instead of sharp, but you've lost all enthusiasm for the talk, all real interest. That happened to a good friend of mine one time. He had been selected for a very important position with his company, a large national corporation, and he deserved it. There was a special banquet at which two or three executives were to be officially promoted before their peers. Each was expected to make a short acceptance speech. My friend, a quiet, very good man, and an excellent manager, was frankly very nervous about getting up at the head table and making a speech, even a short one. The president and chairman of the board were there, along with other top executives. The room was filled with the cream of the corporation. As usual, there was the traditional cocktail party before dinner. My friend, very nervous about the whole thing, downed a martini. It made him feel so good he had another. That gave him so much phony confidence he had a third, and when the time came, after the president's glowing comments about him and news of the new promotion, for him to stand, walk to the podium, and make his short speech of acceptance, my friend was too drunk to get out of his chair. He simply raised his wobbly head and stared in confusion at the sea of horrified faces. The promotion was canceled, of course, and he was sent back to his former post, there to spend the rest of his days with the corporation, unfortunately. It's important to be relaxed when we make a presentation, but it's a special kind of relaxation. It comes from preparation, from knowing the subject, and from being well qualified to speak on it. Now, that includes being alert and sharp. Perry Como, of all the great performers of the past two or three decades, achieved fame not only for his acknowledged talent as a singer and performer, but for his wonderful presence in front of an audience. Bing Crosby is the same way. But Perry Como appeared to be as relaxed and as at home as he would be in his own living room with his family. He gave the impression of enjoying himself in an easygoing, smiling, and relaxed way. He would be my choice as a model worth emulation. We might never achieve his accomplishments in the relaxation department, but we can work toward them. When you get up to give your speech, think of Perry Como appearing before the television cameras and the studio audience, smiling, warm, friendly, and with the talent and hours of rehearsal to give an excellent accounting of himself. He was, and still is on his rare appearances, completely unself-conscious. He doesn't think about himself at all, or at least that's the impression we get. He's thinking only of his audience, what he's doing, and the other people on his show. Now, if we can do the same thing, we'll do a great job. If we can forget ourselves and think only of the audience and our subject, what we're trying to say, to convey, to sell to that group of people, we'll do a very good job indeed. To be self-conscious is to put yourself ahead of the audience and your subject. You're filled with yourself and how you appear, how you sound, how you forget you. Think of two factors. Your audience first, pleasing and informing them, and your subject. Handling it properly, doing it well. You'll come through fine if you'll succeed in doing that. It's the mark of the star. I remember the first time I saw Barbara Streisand. She was just a youngster on her first television appearance, and I remember yet how she sold that song. She gave me goose flesh as she sang that song with all her heart, and I remember saying to my wife at the time, long before she'd finished the number, "That girl is going to be a very big star." There were a few million other people all over the country saying the same thing. A homely, gawky little girl under the spell of that music became beautiful, and all we knew who were watching and listening was that we had never heard that song sung like that before. Barbra Streisand's and Perry Como's are, to be sure, anomalies, few and far between, like 50-carat diamonds. But if we want to be good at what we do, it pays to emulate the best. And the way to do that is to forget ourselves. The same is true of all great salesmen. They're not thinking of themselves, their commissions, or sales records. When they're in front of a customer, they're thinking of him and their product or service as an aid to him. In this way, we can achieve what some of the top athletes have called controlled relaxation. It comes from concentrating on the ball, in our case the speech, and where we want it to go, in our case the audience. Everything else will then fall into place. It doesn't mean that we lose track of time and talk too long. We can check that as we go along. It doesn't mean that we forget to use the mic properly and look at the people in our audience. We can do all those things if we're ready, if we know what we're going to say, and if we're sober and sharp. Being good at anything demands sacrifices of various kinds. It certainly applies to this curious business of standing up in front of the room and talking to a group of people. Thank you.